This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. While age can bring wisdom, it can also induce homnesia, that maddening inability to remember somebody's name. What am I doing here syndrome, which leaves you empty-handed in a doorway wondering what you came in for, and wrong vessel disorder, where you put away a pint of ice cream in the pantry. Middle-aged memory problems can range from the amusing to the annoying to the terrifying. As Catherine Jacobson Raymond crossed the frontiers of middle age, she became increasingly concerned about herself. As a journalist, a quick memory is critical, and she found her once sharp recollection of dates, times, errands, and facts slipping away. She worried about losing her profession and losing her identity. Raymond decided to find out what was going on, so she made herself a guinea pig and subjected herself to all kinds of tests and clinical trials. In her new book, Carved in Sand, she writes about how she got her mojo back. Later in this hour, David Savage of the Los Angeles Times joins us to discuss today's Supreme Court decision to uphold the Partial Birth Abortion Act. But first, lost and found memories. If you've had problems from losing your car keys to worrying about Alzheimer's, if you have questions about the way memory works, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Catherine Jacobson Raymond joins us now from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program today.
Oh, I am delighted to be here.
And you give some examples of your own forgetfulness, and I think several of those citations I mentioned earlier, all of them from your book, were among them. But the one that disturbed you was losing your way in the car, it seemed to me.
Well, losing my way in the car is very annoying, particularly when I've been to the place several times before. But what really spurred me to write this book was the evening that I came out of the movies with my husband,
yes,
got in the car, and within 3 minutes realized that I could not remember the name of the movie. Now, I wasn't even comfortable mentioning this to my husband, because what kind of a ridiculous thing is it when you've just left not to be able to come up with the title? And I said to myself, you know, this is starting to run my life. I am very, very uncomfortable with this, and I am going to have to find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of us have been to movies. We wish we could forget that quickly, but
yes.
There was also the case, as you started to look in this, we talked about some amusing things, but your friend Joanna, and this is not funny at all.
No, it's not funny. My friend Joanna, I met her during the course of my research. She was in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease when I met her. She was about 59, and that was 3 years ago. I found her through the Alzheimer's Association, and I went to visit her. She lived in Southern California. And we spent a very lovely afternoon together. We went out to lunch and we talked as two women might. And she was almost like an older sister figure. And really, I could see that there were some problems with language, very minor memory issues. Well, I talked to her on the phone a lot that year, and then I came back to see her again. And by the time I saw her again, things had changed dramatically. She now had substantial memory issues. She was just a few weeks away from forgetting how to let herself into her house. And now I'm so sorry to say that at about 63 or 4, she is in a board and care, and she doesn't know me anymore. Now, the reason that this is important is that Alzheimer's disease is not a disease of old age. That's what we've been led to think, but all the new research suggests that this is a disease that plants its seeds in midlife. And the only way that we are going to have success with this disease is to learn to diagnose it very early. And the way that that's going to happen is through the use of biomarkers in urine, in blood, in cerebrospinal fluid. And there is a vast initiative underway right now. And they need as many volunteers in midlife as they can possibly get.
I think it's fair to say you were concerned that you might be having the early signs of Alzheimer's yourself.
Well, I have to say that initially it was not really a concern of mine. I didn't believe that. First of all, everyone said, well, that can't be because Alzheimer's is a disease of old age. You develop it in your late 70s or in your 80s. It's not a young person's disease. And that's how I thought going in. I assumed that really there was no way I was very safe. But I went to see Dr. Gary Small at UCLA, mostly because of one of the first books I saw was his, The Memory Bible, which came out 4 years ago, 5 years ago now. And I saw that book and I read it and I did a lot of the quizzes and little tests that he has in the book. And when I added up all my scores, I saw that I fell into the category that said, please see your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured the doctor I ought to see was Gary Small. So I wrote him a long letter, and I said, I don't know if this is going in the garbage, but if you can see your way clear, I think I have a piece for the New York Times Magazine lined up, and I would like to come and have a full evaluation. And he said he would do that if I would be a participant in one of his protocols at UCLA, assuming that I was normal enough to do so.
Yeah.
I spent quite a bit of time at UCLA over the next months going through this evaluation. I had extensive blood tests, memory tests, psychological evaluations, neuropsych evaluations, also a PET scan and an MRI. And in the end, I was normal enough to be part of the protocol, which I did with great pleasure. But there was a little more going on than that.
And we'll get into that, but we want to get some listeners involved in the conversation as well. 800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Catherine Jacobson Raymond, and her book is Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. Let's see if we can begin with, this is Teresa. Teresa is with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, my problem is that I frequently confuse names, maybe, or forget, I guess, since we're talking about memory. Say, like, I've got two students in my class, and one's name's Bill and one name is Bob. Because they have B, I have a hard time pulling out the right name when I want to talk to a specific student.
I have to sympathize with you, Teresa. The first change I made on this program was asking my staff for every program we start to have a sheet of paper that I can put in front of me on a little easel that has the name and title of every guest on the program, because I can meet somebody, read their book, shake their hand, they can sit across the table from me, and I will not be able to remember their name. Catherine, isn't this fairly normal, I hope?
Oh, yes, it is very normal. That doesn't really make it acceptable, unfortunately.
But I didn't say it was acceptable.
Teresa, I just want to say that if you have a class full of students, you have 25, and there's only two that are tripping you up, you're in really good shape. I always wonder how teachers manage that. There are ways that you can avoid it. And basically, if you see these people day after day, over and over again, you can attach a name to a specific physical characteristic. And at that point, that problem will go away. For you, Neil, has a parade of new people coming through every day. I think you're going the right way with the easel.
Let's hope so. Teresa, thanks very much for the call, and good luck with the kids.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email we have from Chris in Wichita, Kansas. Every time I hear descriptions of midlife memory loss symptoms, I chuckle. I've had all of these symptoms from the time I was a small child. I grasp new concepts very quickly. I can remember how things work, if not their names. So I do well in the computer field. Did I just get an early start on memory loss? Should I just plan to forget not just where I parked my car, but even what kind of car I own by the time I'm 40?
Chris, I don't know the answer to that question, because first I'd have to ask you something about your childhood. There are people who are just genetically bound to have very poor memories. Some of the chemicals that are produced to consolidate memory are just not being produced, and this is evident from childhood onward. There's also the possibility of childhood head injury or perhaps repetitive mild traumatic brain injuries, which will affect memory. There's only one good thing about what you're telling me, and that is that people who have never had good memories tend to have great strategies. They have had to build these scaffoldings from early on in life, and they have their techniques. The people who suffer the very most are those who had crackerjack memories well into their late 30s, maybe early 40s, and then the memory got up and left. These people are not accustomed to using strategies. The only thing they ever needed were their brains. They didn't need calendars. They barely needed their assistants. They're not used to keeping a paper trail. And these are the people who just freak out completely.
In part, you say, because it's their identity. It's who they think of themselves as being.
That's right. I mean, if and the people who do not really have the strategies or the scaffolding because their memories have been so good tend to enter professions where the job is essentially stand and deliver, where you have to be good on your feet and you have to be fast and you have to synthesize really quickly. And so you get lawyers and you get journalists and you get teachers, you get people in those kinds of professions. You often get CEOs who are very much in the public eye. And when that ability to find the words and formulate the sentences, and I say when the metaphor machine breaks and these things aren't just flowing out of your mouth anymore, then that can be very detrimental to self-esteem and self-confidence.
And especially bad for those, as you suggest, in their 40s and 50s, but not so bad, you also suggest, for people a little bit older who are maybe not so stressed in their lives, are not so busy, not doing so many things, and can take things a little easier.
Well, a study that I read by Dr. Thomas Crook showed something very interesting, which is that people in their 40s and 50s feel much worse about their memories than people in their 60s and 70s. Their memories are, in fact, worse in their 60s and 70s, but they are not so bothered by it. Because, as you say, Neil, the pressure is off. You no longer come home to a house full of adolescents. You may have slowed down your work life somewhat or not. I mean, both my parents still work full time, and one is my mother's in her 70s and my father's in his 80s. So it's not like it always slows down. But a lot of the demands are letting up, and so it's more tolerable.
We're talking with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond about the frustrations of midlife memory loss and how she got her mojo back. The book is called Carved in Sand. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond about her book Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. We have an excerpt from her book. You can read about the frustrations of midlife forgetfulness at our website, npr.org/talk. And, of course, you're welcome to join the conversation. If you have trouble remembering names or where those darn car keys are, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And at our blog, you can read what other listeners have to say. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And I wanted to get another caller on the line, and this is Terry. Terry, another caller from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi.
I had an interesting situation where I lost memory after prolonged sleep deprivation. Mm-hmm. I used to have a telephone answering service, and in the mid-90s, it was going down the tubes, and I began to work more and more hours, eventually only sleeping about 15 minutes at a time. And I lost my ability to say simple words. I could only get the first letter of the word. I would say, you know, I would want to say table, and I could only come up with
Terry, I'm not at all surprised. There's a chapter in my book about sleep deprivation, in fact, and it is a major factor in maintaining your cognitive stability over the years. Most of memory consolidation, in fact, occurs during your sleep cycles, in particular during slow wave sleep, which is a very deep sleep. And we need 3 full sleep cycles a night. Each one takes at least 2.5 hours. So what does that tell you about sleeping 15-minute cycles? You never were going into slow wave sleep. If you were, you were probably falling directly into REM sleep and waking yourself up, and it's hard to envision how that could have been worse. But it's actually not quite to that extent, but it's a very common problem. Because our world is so much 24/7, everything is available to us all day, all night, there is this tremendous drive to burn the candle at both ends. And there are two ways this plays out. One is in insomnia, which is extremely common in midlife, and the other is in what I call volitional sleep deprivation, which is what you chose to do, and obviously under duress. You had to keep your business afloat. But it's not a successful strategy because it makes your mind so foggy that you make so many mistakes that you end up having to sweep up after yourself. And in terms of sweeping up, another function of sleep also occurring during slow wave is what I refer to as the neuronal housekeeper hour, where a lot of unnecessary information is swept out of your brain so that you are not staggering under loads that are not necessary for daily function.
Yeah, the old memory dump.
Right. We don't want to remember everything. You don't need to know how all your coworkers were dressed. It's just not critical. And if you don't sleep, you are burdened with all kinds of garbage and really have a hard time accessing the information you need.
Terry, good luck and get some sleep.
Thank you.
Okay. And it's interesting, the last two conversations, you talked about childhood bumps on the head and mild brain problems from that and sleep deprivation. Those were two of your problems, weren't they?
Yes, both of them were my problems. I had a mild traumatic head injury when I was about 9 years old. My brother was enjoying playing with a broomstick, spinning in circles with the broomstick held out laterally, enjoying centripetal force. I think he was considering a career as a physicist at the time. He was seven. And I came down the basement stairs and blithely walked headlong into this spinning broomstick. And I went in adult life recently, I calculated what the probable force was of a broomstick spinning that fast. And it's essentially like being hit by a car that's going 30 miles an hour. So at the time, my forehead and eyes turned absolutely black and then purple and then yellow. And my fourth grade teacher, should he be listening, will remember calling me Miss Technicolor for a good part of the year. But nobody knew at the time that you ought to look into this or that you could expect sequelae that were very, very serious 3 months down the road. The results of a head injury like that don't usually appear immediately because it takes a while for the axons to die. They don't just click off, and 3, 4, 6 months later, you start to see problems with working memory. You start to see problems with processing speed. Usually, they're not acknowledged, especially in children. You know, the children have developed a learning disability somehow, but nobody connects it to the injury.
Joining us now is Dr. Edward Halliwell. He's a psychiatrist and author of the book Crazy, Busy, Overstretched, Overbooked, and About to Snap Strategies for Handling Your Fast-Paced Life. He's with us from his home in Arlington, Massachusetts. Doctor, nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be with you. And Catherine, hello.
Hi, Ned. How are you? I told you we'd be doing this together someday.
Wonderful. It's really wonderful.
And she remembered.
Yeah, and I did too. Really remarkable. And well, I tell you what to do, Neil, so you remember automatically.
Oh, I don't remember anything, and I certainly don't remember it after the show's over. But I do have to ask you, is there a distinction, is there any way somebody can tell when the difference between relatively normal, if unacceptable, middle-aged memory loss and something they really need to worry about?
Well, it's hard to do it on your own. I mean, I think that's why people are flocking to their primary care provider, you know, complaining of early Alzheimer's. I think it's the number one chief complaint, along with anxiety. So people are flocking to their doctors. But I think that's good. I mean, you really ought to go to your doctor. Don't be the old stiff upper lip and wait until you're, you know, can't remember your way home. Mm-hmm. It's good to get a professional evaluation because while most of the time it's just a severe case of modern life, you know, and really we are asking the human brain to process infinitely more data points than ever before in human history. Why? Because it's possible. You know, so there's been a real phase shift in terms of what we're asking the brain to do in the past decade than ever before in human history. So hence, it's only normal that a lot of people would think they're losing their memory because they have infinitely more data points to keep track of. But so the chances are your doctor will tell you, no, you've just got a case of modern life. But you might have depression. You might have a thyroid condition. You might have something I specialize in, attention deficit disorder. So it's worth making sure you don't have one of these treatable conditions before you just assume it's a severe case of modern life and then go about doing the things Catherine will tell you to do.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, what I discovered as I went through the 10 interventions that I go through in the book is that one's internist, however wonderful one's internist is very unlikely to pick up any of this. One's internist is likely, especially if he or she is in midlife, is likely to pat you on the back and say, you know what, it's right. happening to me too, and that's about as far as they can go.
Right.
You know, until perhaps, you know, my book will change that and maybe some of the midlife studies of cognition are going to make it onto the desks of internists.
Right.
But they're very likely to give you at best the MMSE, which is an extremely simple test. You practically, right. you have to really be dementing before you can't get 100 on that test. It's not a fair form of evaluation.
Yes.
And studies are showing that if you believe that your memory is progressively declining. It's not the same from month to month. You can know that it's getting worse. Then what you need to do is take yourself to a university research center for memory or Alzheimer's disease and have an evaluation and become part of a research protocol. Because of the three or four people that I interviewed who developed Alzheimer's disease in middle age, not one of them was diagnosed in a timely way. All were diagnosed with depression. All missed the window of opportunity for treatment.
Sure. And the one that I specialize in, attention deficit disorder, there are millions of adults out there who don't know it, and their doctor doesn't even know that it exists, you know, that you can have ADD as an adult. So yes, it's usually your primary care physician is not nearly enough. And the good news is about these conditions, when we treat them, there's a remarkable difference. Now, you came to see me wondering if you had ADD, and I told you didn't. So
that's right.
So, you know, not everybody who can't focus and remember has ADD, but a sizable chunk do, and most doctors don't know how to diagnose it. And that's a shame, because diagnosing ADD in adulthood, you know, leads to a remarkable improvement. I mean, it really is, for a lot of folks, a 180-degree turn in their life.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and this is Kathy. Kathy with us from St. Louis.
Hi. Very quickly, before my battery goes out, I'm middle-aged, did have a mild head trauma when I was a child, have Alzheimer's prevalent on one side of my family, and would love to get a workup, but I'm horrified that my insurance and future jobs would suffer for it if there's some record that this is in my future.
Hmm.
Well, that can be an issue, and I think
it was for your friend Joanna when she got the diagnosis. She had to leave her partnership in the law firm.
Well, she did have to leave simply because her partners wanted her to. I mean, there's no legal way that you can be made to leave a job based on a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But you can be not be able to get a driver's license or have your license revoked if you have the diagnosis. But Kathy, let me say this, that first of all, a serious head trauma, a major head trauma, does increase the risk of the development of Alzheimer's disease. And if, in fact, you are having these problems and you may be going downhill, there are ways that this can be treated now, not later. They're having a very good result treating with Exelon, which is a drug often given for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. They're using it to treat people with head injuries. And in some ways, that could stave this off for years and years, or at least you'll have an answer. So I would put, you know, this long-range problem behind you right now, so their short-range problem behind you, and deal with the potential of a long-range problem.
Thanks very much.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Isabel in Lake Oswego in Oregon. My husband had open heart surgery at the age of 46. Since surgery, his memory has been poor. He insists that being on the heart and lung machine for about 2 hours has caused memory loss. Can being on a heart and lung machine for so long cause memory loss? Dr. Hallowell?
Sure. You know, it's remarkable how many brain insults, and that doesn't mean telling someone they've got an ugly brain. It means, you know, anything that interrupts the normal flow of blood and oxygen to your brain, how many diverse brain insults can lead to memory loss, transient or permanent. And a lot of times we forget these. I mean, Catherine mentioned head injury. Most people, as children, had significant head injuries, and they're long forgotten. But they can have a serious impact in adult life.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is such a syndrome as what is called pump head. It literally exists. And this lady is absolutely correct, or her husband is correct, that there have been several studies done, and I mention them in my book, about the cognitive effects of open-heart surgery. You are on a pump for a long time, and blood is not getting to your brain in the same amounts, and there are results from that, yes. Mm. She's right.
We're talking with Dr. Edward Hallowell, a psychiatrist with the Hallowell Center, and author of Crazy Busy, Overstretched, Overbooked, and About to Snap Strategies for Handling Your Fast-Paced Life, and with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond, whose book is Carved in Sand, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Catherine, I have to say that some of the remedies for how you got your mojo back, they sound like stuff that our doctors tell us to do all the time. Get plenty of sleep, get some exercise, and eat a good diet.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You know, it's amazingly easy, actually. But we as midlifers find many ways to avoid doing that. In order to keep your brain in top health, you really need to consume an awful lot of antioxidants. And I say to get as many as you need, you'd essentially have to be a grazing animal. I mean, you you could never, ever stop eating. It would be going on day and night.
A ruminant.
A ruminant would be best.
Catherine, don't you think fish oil is a good way to do it?
I think it's a great way to do. Well, actually, fish oil is better in terms of omega-3s.
Right, right.
That's what that's about.
Right.
But basically, you can supplement your diet with antioxidant supplements, and that can be very helpful. But you have to remember that they are much better absorbed through actual food consumed, because this food spends more time in the gut, and so the absorption level is much, much higher. There are lots of supplements that are in play here as helpful. And, you know, all supplements are unregulated, and the studies are not necessarily all that great. And any time you hear that something's really good, you can count on the next week hearing how bad it is.
Yeah.
But the people that I interviewed, the scientists I interviewed, you know, were fairly much in agreement on the necessity of lots of omega-3 fatty acids, which is, as Ned says, found in fish oil capsules, very easy to take, increased amounts of magnesium, coenzyme Q10, alpha-lipoic acid. One of the commonly taken supplements is ginkgo biloba, and the studies do not suggest that this is particularly effective. What ginkgo biloba does is increase the blood supply to the brain. So if that's a factor, if there are cardiovascular issues, et cetera, they could be helpful. But it is certainly not the panacea that, some of our health food stores would like us to think.
Mm-hmm. Could I mention one other in the lifestyle issue? Because I think these days it's so overlooked. And it's simply regular doses of positive human contact.
Yes.
You know, people these days, the great paradox is we're electronically super connected, but we're interpersonally disconnecting, and people need, you know, a smiling face, an affirmation, a pat on the back, two or three times a day. You know, and if you don't get it, you get a vitamin deficiency syndrome. I call it, you know, a vitamin connect deficiency, and the symptoms can be memory loss, can be depression, can be just lethargy and less than peak performance. So it's worth it to stick your head into someone's office and say hello now and then.
And Catherine, you suggested early on in your book that you hated taking pills. You've gotten over that.
Yes, well, I kind of had to in order to write the book. You know, I was somebody who only took vitamins when I was pregnant because I had to. It was really not my thing. No other pills were my thing either. And yet, during the course of this and some of these interventions, I've swallowed, you know, just handfuls of vitamins. I've also swallowed some cognitive enhancing drugs, particularly in my case, Adderall and Provigil. I have had some very good results with Provigil. Adderall was not too great for me. It definitely helped with the cognitive issues, but it dropped me like a bomb at the end of the day every day. And so I believe that cognitive enhancing pharmaceuticals are coming on the market. They are being adopted very widely. I'm almost shocked and appalled to learn how many people are taking these. And we're not only talking about the ADD generation, which is, of course, now hitting its 20s and has never spent a day in its life without Ritalin, so is continuing to take these drugs.
Remember, we've been using one for centuries, which is caffeine.
Right. And that's and Ned, that's yours, right? That's all you do, Ned.
That's what I do. That's what. Let me just say quickly.
Very quickly, if you would.
Okay, just what Catherine has done is remarkable, and she's not going to say this herself, but the journey she went on that she reports in this book it's like no other book I've ever seen. It's a remarkable book full of reliable information. She knows more than 9 out of 10 doctors do about the mind and memory now. It's a wonderful book.
The book
Ned,
is carved,
I love you.
The book is Carved in Sand. Its author is Catherine Jacobson Raymond, and we thank her for her time. Dr. Halliwell, thank you as well.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with David Savage about the Supreme Court decision upholding the Partial Birth Abortion Act. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.